Picture this. You're in a city where you don't speak the language, you don't recognize the road signs, and the cars behave like they're all in on a joke that you've never been told. But the reality is that it's not you as the confused tourist. It's actually a self-driving car from Arizona. In February 2023, Waymo proudly announced that its autonomous vehicles had driven over 1 million miles on U.S. roads without a human behind the wheel. Fewer accidents than human drivers, like safety stats, and the future apparently had arrived. But here's the catch. The future was tested on a very specific slice of the world. Wide roads, clear signage, relatively orderly traffic, and a particular set of cultural norms about what good driving looks like. Our guest today is Katrina Reinecke. She argues that technology is never just about the code and clever algorithms. It always carries the fingerprints of whatever culture that made it. And when those digital fingerprints are pressed into other parts of the world, they don't always fit. Now, whether it's from Cairo traffic to South Korean search engines, we're going to talk about what happens when technology behaves as if everyone, everywhere, thinks like a designer in Silicon Valley. I'm Autumn FNAF, and this episode of Breaking Math is about power, perception, and the quiet shock you feel when technology clearly wasn't built with you in mind. What is the definition of digital culture shock?
It's basically very similar to what we experience in interpersonal culture shock when we go abroad, when we meet people from a very different cultural background, people who, you know, might have different clothes on. Sometimes we just see different buildings. Food is a big, you know, big one too, right? And I don't know whether you've experienced this before, but when you experience culture shock, it's really unsettling, right? It's this feeling of, maybe initially we are very excited about it, about all these, you know, different inputs. But after a while, we definitely often have this feeling of just not really knowing what these signals are. We can't really interpret them. And it's sort of a feeling of anxiety. And researchers have actually found that there is people can become more anxious, they can develop depression. There are physiological signals that people, like, for example, they have increase in blood pressure and things like that, right? So culture shock is really real in interpersonal communication, and it is actually not very different in digital culture shock. So when people experience a technology that is developed by people unlike themselves, so people with different cultural values, for example, it might be a little more subtle, but people will notice something is off. Something isn't quite as I expected. And maybe I will find things not quite as intuitive as I was hoping for, right? And users tend to blame themselves. They tend to say, it's me, right? I am not able to use this software. But in my field, in human-computer interaction, we would actually say, no, it's not the user's fault, right? It's the designer's fault for not anticipating how the user will perceive the software or the technology and how it should be designed to be more intuitive. And so when there was a mismatch between how the software is designed and how the user perceives it, that's what I would call a digital culture shock.
So you start your book with an autonomous vehicle, Waymo as the example, right?
Right.
So do you want to talk about some of the autonomous cars and what actually happens in that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by self-driving cars because I, for the longest time, did not believe this would be possible. And I'm still not 100% convinced, but the reason I put this example into the book is because, right, the way Waymo has launched it is actually quite smart. They tested the cars in very, what I would call almost controlled environments, right? Very safe environments, so to say. So, you know, when I give a talk on this subject, I often include an image of a very nice streetscape where you have lane markings that are 100% correct and everything is sort of easily predictable. And I would say that's very different from most of the world. When you go to a different country, so the example I use in the book is Cairo, Egypt, you won't find a setting like that, right? Suddenly, it'll be pedestrians on the street, donkey cars. There will be more buses. It will be just generally what some researchers call a bit more chaotic driving behavior, right? And it's not just a place like Egypt. It's, you know, I've seen similar situations all over the world. It's not even in France or Italy or so, right? Like, I just simply don't believe self-driving cars could be as safe as they have been proven to be in the US. And now you might have heard about, a few accidents here and there, and that is definitely still the case. I think Waymo itself has a pretty good history. When you look through their data, it's a fairly safe bet at this point for them. But again, only in these very controlled environments. And, actually, just I think a few months ago, Waymo started testing in Seattle, partly because they didn't have any data on rainy streets, right? And maybe also the potholes in Seattle and so on. I don't know. But, that just shows you can't just transplant something that has been trained in one country or in one part of the country to another. It's just not how this works. And I would say that's the same for all of technology. I also started with this example because I feel like there's sort of an analogy between how cars are trained on data and then are able to predict the environment around them, and how we as the developers or designers of software are trained, right? We also gain experience throughout our lives and it forms our culture. That data is basically what we take and what we use to react to technology and use it, but also to develop it and design it if we are in that kind of job.
So something that you talk about in the book is American assumptions, right? So whether that's a driving car or data that ends up embedded in a robo-axis, what happens with that data and how does that transform from one scenario to the other?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I'm calling it an American scenario is sort of because the assumption that people want to have self-driving cars, to me, is already a very US-American assumption, right? It's sort of a, like, many people in the US drive to work, and the idea of commuting by themselves is probably very unique in the world. In most places, that's just not the case. People commute together, there's public transport, or they share rides, or they might just commute by foot or bikes and so on, right? So this idea of having long commutes by car and that being a really uncomfortable experience, and so you need to have self-driving cars to alleviate that, that is a very American assumption to me. And, there are definitely lots of upsides to self-driving cars, and I don't want to be in the position to talk it down because we know that it's also, it can make things more accessible for people and so on, right? So there are people who definitely benefit from it. But I think, after all, it is a very, very US assumption to have even this need. And so the other question I think that you had is sort of about this data that we're training it on, right? So if we are training robot cars, just the same as all of AI, right? If we're training that on Western data, we cannot assume that it's going to work for other contexts. It just doesn't transplant like that. And it'll break and actually lead to culture shocks. And I think this can backfire for businesses because they don't necessarily want to have a flop in a different country, right? It can also be, in the case of self-driving cars, it can actually have a severe security and safety implication. And ultimately, it can be very upsetting for users if things are not designed for them. And so that's sort of what I talk through in the book with various different examples.
So do you have a favorite example that you've gone through in the book?
There's so many examples that I find it really hard to say this is the example. But I will say that the self-driving car example for me is a good one to just sort of tell people we can't just take something from one context to the other. But then later I do talk about ChatGPT, for example, and, some of the earlier models in AI. And we have done a lot of research, but many others have done similar research on looking at how these are biased towards the more English data they're trained on. And often that data comes from people in the US, right? And that data is inherently biased towards the views of mostly North American people. And, you can see this in when you ask these language models, these AI chatbots, when you ask them questions about, for example, the World Value Survey, which is a large-scale survey that social scientists have done with people around the world to understand their values, when you ask a chatbot these questions, you'll see that it gives out responses that are very much aligned with people in Western countries, but not very aligned with people in the rest of the world. And so you can just imagine, right, if a chatbot is there and tells you about, it's made it doesn't believe in equality, or maybe it does believe in equality, right? But if these things don't align with your values, it is really a problem. And what we've shown in our research is that it actually, when people interact with it, even within just 5 minutes, it can trigger reactions very similar to culture shock, including this feeling that it has a negative influence on your well-being and so on.
Technology isn't culturally neutral. Now, what are some of the most important values or norms that you see when quietly encoded into some of these mainstream digital products? You just talked about ChatGPT, but there's other AI training models as well.
This is a great question. One of the most prevalent assumptions, and I would call it a misassumption, is that technology is always about efficiency. And I have to admit that I grew up in Germany and I did my PhD in Switzerland, and I felt like it was sort of indoctrinated in me that we need to be efficient, and people in Germany tend to be on clock time rather than on event time. But we really, the clocks in our lives really rule our daily procedures and so on. And so designing technology around this idea of efficiency and making things more efficient has always been very natural to me. But I'm starting to question that, because some of the research we've done is that, you know, where we've actually looked at how do people interact with each other online. What we saw over and over again is that there are many people around the world, often people who tend to be more collectivistic, so more group-oriented. You know, they might take a longer time to build trust with each other, and they actually work really hard to maintain relationships and to build them in the first place. And all of that requires a lot of social interaction, right? And yes. As Westerners, we sometimes tend to cancel out that social interaction in the name of productivity and efficiency. And for me, that is the greatest single misassumption, that, you know, why do we need to make everything in life more efficient? Why don't we try to actually make it much more about social interactions? And, you know, again, that's a very individualistic assumption that might seem very natural for people in the US and in many Western countries, where it often is about, I am an individual and I'm going to worship my own time and protect it as much as I can, right?
From an engineering perspective, or as a computer scientist who thinks that good design is just good design, how would you convince someone that the design itself speaks to a particular cultural point of view instead of humanity as a whole?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think something that I'm also still struggling with. I mean, my approach was to write the book, right? To convince people that we have all these different values in the world. And I can say with some certainty that I don't think all of these values are worth supporting through technology. But at the same time, there are many values that who am I to say that my values are the right ones, right? And so, you know, partly I think when we become more aware of these cultural differences across the world, and we see that, you know, some people, it's simple things like, you know, some people might not prefer a user interface that's as plain and white and gray as many user interfaces in Germany often are, right? Some people might like it, you know, way more colorful, for example. Some people might not like software to tell them to not have any chit-chat in the online forums in the name of efficiency, right?
Yes.
Instead, what we've seen, and you were mentioning India, right? Like, we've seen that Indian participants in our studies were often saying, no, we like having to, we like being able to talk to each other and having this chit-chat in order to build these relationships. And yes, we still want an answer to our questions in these question and answer forums, but we don't see the urgency to get this right away as some of our Western counterparts do.
So underneath a lot of these apps and devices, there's decades of research about how humans think and behave, or at least what they claim. So when we look closely at humans and when they're being tested in the lab, it turns out that a very large portion were Western educated, industrialized, rich, and living in democracies. So these so-called weird populations, which is being studied like penguins. So for listeners who haven't heard of this term before, what are weird populations? Where does it come from? And why does this acronym matter?
Yeah, so this acronym was coined by psychologists who found that most studies are done with North American undergraduates, right? And it's very simple. We do a lot of research in North America, and then we tend to just study people who are readily available, right? And so these are North American undergraduates who often have to take these studies for a credit or just to earn a little bit of money and so on, right? It's a very simple thing. But it has these unintended side effects of that we know a lot of knowledge and, you know, we know a lot about the behavior and the thinking and how people use technology in North America, but we don't really know very much about the rest of the world. And in fact, in some of our studies, we found that, you know, we only know things about roughly 12% of the population because the rest of the population is just almost never being studied. And this is an issue because for the longest time, we've actually assumed that a lot of these human behaviors are very universal. And now we found, whoops, they're not. These psychologists at some point published a paper and they called it the weirdest people in the world. And in that paper, they showed how the findings about North American undergraduates tend to be on the extreme end of a spectrum when you compare it to other populations across the world. And this is anything from how people make decisions to how they behave in other settings and so on. And so we ultimately, when we design technology following these ideas about weird populations, we make that technology, we basically optimize it for weird people and we leave out everybody else.
Given this weird bias, what's an example of universal design or guidelines that fall apart from the moment we test something somewhere else? I know you talk a little bit about certain forums.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is really difficult because I personally do not believe in universal design. I don't think there is any designs out there that are really universally suitable for everybody. And, you know, people might want to fight me on this, but I will also say that I think we just simply don't know enough yet because we often don't study people around the world, as we just discussed, right? And so I could bet that even the simplest design wouldn't work for everybody, and maybe because it is too simple. So ultimately, my big belief is that it would be way better if we had people around the world designing technology and coming together. In my field of human-computer interaction, we often say we need to study people, we need to do user-centered design, we need to go into those communities and study people and then develop software for them. But even that is difficult because if you come in from one set of values and take them and design for another, let's say, cultural group, you will still impose your own values on that group, right? It's really difficult to not to do that. So ultimately, I think the idea of local software is what the world needs. And that's, of course, really difficult given that we have, you know, the largest tech companies are in the US, and that might not change anytime soon.
Now, you have something, speaking of the larger tech companies, you have minimalist Google versus the busy, what is it, Naver?
Naver, yeah. Naver is a South Korean search engine. And
yes,
used to be for the longest time, really the one with the largest market share in South Korea. I believe at this point, Google has sort of caught up to it. But for the longest time, they weren't sure what made Naver so much more popular among people in South Korea.
Yeah. So and as living in the US, I've never heard of that before. Now, was there anything in particular that made Naver more successful, especially when you're looking at how culture shapes what people search for using the engine?
Yeah, yeah. So lots of different things. So when you go to the website, naver.com, it's actually really difficult to provide an image of it because what's really fascinating about it is that it's not an aesthetic website.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's blinking and it has bright colors. It actually used to be even more colorful than it is today. And so I think partly that already appeals to the visual preferences of many people in South Korea, right? We can't stereotype here. There is lots of variation. But by and large, I will say that South Korean websites tend to be a little bit more colorful than those in Germany, for example, right? But there is another aspect about it, and that's that Google has a lot of answers for everybody, but they are usually English. It's the English internet that it'll give you, right? The South Korean market is, of course, much, much smaller. And so when people were searching for answers, they didn't necessarily want to just, like, a search result from the US or something wouldn't be necessarily relevant. And so one of the big features on Naver is that it's not just random search results that you get returned, but it's the community that answers. And so that's really interesting because, again, it goes back to this idea of socializing and building trust with people. And, you know, South Koreans, then maybe that's a really large in-group for themselves, but it basically means that these people are more likely to trust the search results that are given by people like themselves.
So essentially, it's kind of a digital corner store instead of a sterile search box.
Right, exactly.
Now, yeah, you can. Are there cultural values that are wrapped into that?
That part I am not sure about. So I think what we've seen is that in East Asian countries, we often have these one-stop shop corner store ideas in the online world, right? And platforms that where you can do anything from searching to seeing the weather to trading stocks to going shopping and all of that, right, in one platform. And these mega platforms tend to not be a thing in the Western world. But I actually don't know which cultural values would align with that idea of designing such huge online platforms.
Because what I've seen, just thinking about this, you have Yahoo Japan mm-hmm. and Baidu is the other yeah. platform. And yeah. it seems as if Google is so slow to recognize that a minimal interface wasn't just a one-size-fits-all solution. Let's take it back to even AOL in the 90s. Mm-hmm. You would pop up with that homepage and all the color is right there. Yep. Are we just seeing that it's being as like a cut-and-paste solution for us in the Western world, making things look so sterile and standard?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, there seems to be something here, right? Somebody came along and said, we need to make this really simple. And, you know, like the simplistic design was basically what made Google really famous and people loved it, right? In the Western world. And it's fascinating to me, actually, because I do think that this, It doesn't translate to other contexts, but I also think there was something there already that many usability experts were always saying, you know, the least information you have on the user interface, the better. That was always, you know, we were told that's the case. And clearly in this case, it didn't hold true for other contexts and for other countries around the world, right? And so it's interesting. Somebody made that assumption. They clearly had that value. It worked out okay for people in Western countries, but then that promise sort of broke when they tried to enter other markets around the world.
So we also see this parallel in using Stack Exchange. I'll date myself a few years back when I was in grad school. I noticed that there was a huge contrast in students and how they searched and sourced their information, because a lot of folks here just know of Stack Exchange, while you have another very huge platform, which is Zihu. And those two platforms are built around questions and answers, but very different expectations. Do you want to talk about the differences in them and how they source their answers?
Yeah. So again, the interesting part is that Stack Exchange, promise of Stack Exchange is to make everything way more efficient, right? You want an answer, it's going to be right there on top. And it's being sourced from the answers of a community that is contributing to Stack Exchange, right? A few years ago, a student came to me. His name is Nijini Oliveira, and he's from Brazil and has actually worked with me ever since. But back then when he came to me, he was saying, you know, Katarina, I think Stack Exchange is really one of these examples that's super individualistic. And I was like, really? How so? And he was pointing out all these different things on the platform that I had never really noticed. But it is this focus on efficiency again that he was pointing out. So it'll say things like, there's no chit-chat here. And actually in its guidelines, Stack Exchange will even say, don't thank people when they provide an answer. You can just upvote the answer instead, right? But there shouldn't be this clutter on the interface when you thank somebody. And so he went through the entire platform and did a value-sensitive design analysis of the whole interface. And he found ton of these examples that basically showed everything should be about efficiency. And again, that's really different from how Many people prefer to work with each other and, you know, just taking an answer from somebody that you haven't even known and making it all about competition. That's really the difference here. And now, you know, Stack Exchange is also really interesting because this upvoting has worked in many ways in the Western context, right? How a lot of Westerners are being motivated to contribute something to the platform, right? And so they will go on and answer questions or post questions too, and they will gain a little score. But when we asked Indians and Chinese participants about their feeling about this and how they might want to redesign this, they repeatedly said to us, we don't like being reduced to a score. And we also don't really like this form of competition. Instead, we'd like to work together in a group and become experts at this and really develop relationships with each other so that we can help each other.
Now, thinking about this in another sense, in places like Namibia and Qatar, people adapt Facebook to local hierarchies and norms, right? So, for example, who's allowed to friend whom? And what do these adaptations tell us about the limits of supposedly egalitarian global platforms?
Right. I think it's super interesting to look at Facebook because the assumption was always everybody should just be able to reach out to anybody else and befriend that person, right? Everybody's also suddenly on a first name basis, which is my friends and students in India always laugh at this. They're like, I would not even call my dad with, you know, his first name. It's just not something you do. So in Western societies, it might be way more common. But I think, again, it's especially common in the US and not so much in many other places. But yeah, this idea of just reaching out to, you know, a person and befriending them, that assumes that it's a very flat society. But we know from lots of cultural theory that there's, for example, this concept called power distance, right? So different cultures have a different power differential in society. They see equality differently. They might have more of a hierarchy and so on. And so this idea of reaching out to somebody might actually be almost offensive when that person is higher up in hierarchy. And it could also be the other way around. But again, because Facebook doesn't have any affordance to change the way somebody reaches out to somebody else, it's sort of, you know, it opposes this Western mindset on many other societies. And actually, that's one of the examples where when I tell people about this concept of digital culture shock, that's one of the examples they often will refer to and say, that's when I first noticed that software is just simply not designed for us.
Now, as we move deeper in the book, the stakes get higher. It's not just about preference, it's also about power. So whether this is ride-sharing apps in Dhaka with English interfaces are fixed, or when AI image generators redraw South Asia to look like Western Europe. So what happens when technology stops being a tool? It starts feeling like a new empire, and especially one that colonizes meaning instead of territory. What, in your view, made cases more than just a bad localization job? Let's take Uber, for example, and make it look like a form of digital colonialism. What, in your view, made that case for more than just a bad localization job?
For me, the imperialist discussion isn't necessarily only about content moderation, right? That's maybe one of the very strong example of it, I think. Where it's very apparent, right? Somebody owns this platform, makes the decisions. I talk about some of the examples that came up from other researchers in my community, in the human-computer interaction community, and many of them have studied, for example, Uber being deployed in Dhaka and Bangladesh, right? Or Quora being deployed also actually in Bangladesh, and this idea that it's now a Bengali platform. So it serves the Bengali language market, but that market actually spans both Bangladesh and India. And so there is a lot of, you know, I describe this in more detail in the book, but there's, you know, basically people assuming maybe the people who are moderating and making the decisions about which post goes through are maybe Indians, or maybe they are on the Bangladesh side. Like, people are sort of speculating about it online. There's also the example of Facebook making moderation decisions about what photos they will accept and which ones they will moderate and ultimately remove. And so, you know, in Islam, people often, maybe not routinely, but, you know, for certain festivals around the year, they they will post photos of animal sacrifices on Facebook. And of course, for a Westerner, this might be shocking to see. And so at some point, Facebook made the decision that whenever that happens, a photo like that appears, it will be censored and taken down. And that's a decision, right? You can argue, okay, Facebook is a Western company, maybe they can make that decision, but it has huge implications for those communities who are also users of the system. Facebook is also profiting off those people and making money off of them, collecting their data and so on. Ultimately, a fellow researcher said, you know, we have this tendency of secularizing everything and trying to make technology seem like it is completely secular, but it is not. Because by making decisions like this of taking down animal sacrifices and photos of them, we are basically imposing a very Western and maybe Christian viewpoint on these platforms.
So generative AI, most likely, when you're taking those examples, generative AI will produce Western-looking results.
Right.
Now, what kind of harm does that actually cause for implications for those realities who are affected?
Yeah, so ultimately, people feel marginalized, right? When you see, let's say you're trying to use a text-to-image model and you're asking it to generate houses of worship, and all it generates is maybe churches, right? Rather than any of the various different houses of worship that could be more familiar to people in places around the world, then that makes people feel marginalized and sort of not seen. It feels them being overruled by the technology and its decisions. And so, you know, in human-computer interaction and in many other fields, people have called this a form of digital colonialism. It's sort of this idea of, you know, really, it's a new form of colonialism where decisions are being made by tech companies that are often situated in Western context, not always, but many times. And they make these decisions and basically transfer values and impose them on people around the world.
Now, when an AI sounds like it shares the values of this digital colonialism, what worries you the most about these systems, especially if they become everyday infrastructure?
Yeah, one of the big worries I have is that we become more and more dependent on them, right? And as you said, like, it is a form of infrastructure. It is, you know, not that different from our electricity grid or, you know, maybe, you know, other utilities that we rely on every day. And putting that power into the hands of maybe a handful of people who really rule most of these technologies, that's, you know, could be really difficult. Like, it basically means that those people get to decide what all of us use. We have seen that technology can really over time change how people do things and ultimately change people's values. I would say AI is even more powerful than all of the technology we already use because it makes it seem so human-like. And so this anthropomorphization really leads us to more quickly adopt the values.
So essentially, should these systems code switch, whether that's changing tone, behavior, values, visual style, to fit different contexts?
So the short answer is maybe. It's a difficult answer. It's actually part of our ongoing research, because what we found is that when we make these systems code switch, some people actually find it creepy, right? It's almost like, well, come on, we know this technology was designed by some Western guy in Silicon Valley, maybe, and now it's pretending to be like me. That's basically, it amounts to mimicry, and it's something that not everybody appreciates. For a long time, I have thought that would be the answer, right? Just adapt these systems and then everything will be good. But I actually no longer believe that's the case. I think what we really need is more voices in technology development. And ultimately, you know, this is about technology hegemony and who has the power to rule the technology that the world uses. But I actually firmly believe that we should distribute that power a little bit more and have people around the world develop technology for themselves.
So when you're developing technology for yourself, for listeners who may never design an interface but use technology constantly, what are some concrete questions that they could start asking, whether it's about their apps or the tools that they use or things that they should notice when you have systems that are aligned with their values and when they're not?
I mean, I think as soon as they notice it's not aligned with their values, I think that's actually the the big step. And that's a huge achievement already, because I think the big issue is that we often assume technology is culturally neutral. And that assumption is what often leads us to, you know, just sort of change our behaviors and so on. But as soon as we notice, like, no, it's not culturally neutral. This was designed by somebody and it's not necessarily designed for me. And it's not me who I have to blame for not knowing how to use it, not feeling comfortable with it and all of these things, right? I think that's a really big first step. And something that right, pushing back against that is maybe the next step. But I think just noticing it and making sure that you don't blame yourself for any of the usability issues you might experience, I think that's already a huge step in the right direction.
So I heard that you were running something called Lab in the Wild. What is it?
Yeah, so Lab in the Wild is my response to collecting to the weird problem. Lab in the Wild is a virtual online platform that anybody can participate in. It's almost like a citizen science platform where people around the world can go to take part in our experiments and test themselves. You can learn something about yourself. So every experiment will, at the end, tell you how you performed in comparison to others, how, you know, where you stand on different cultural dimensions, for example. We developed Lab in the Wild to learn more about how people use technology around the world. But there are lots of tests on there now that I also integrated into the book so that people can actually test their own cultural background. And I'm hoping that this enables people to just become a little bit more aware of their own implicit biases, where they sit on the scale of, let's say, individualism versus collectivism. We talked about clock time earlier and event time and all of these things, right? What kind of communicator they are. All of these are influenced by our cultural background. And so knowing more about that, I think, can really be helpful.
Is there any big takeaway that you want people to know from whether it's this conversation or your research or the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said most of these things already, but I, you know, ultimately the reason I wrote the book is to increase people's awareness that technology isn't culturally neutral. It's also the fact that technology companies have so much power over our lives in making little decisions that many of the technology developers might not even notice themselves they're making, right? There's so many very little design decisions everybody has to make when they develop technology that it is often not apparent to people that, wow, that was actually based on my own cultural experience. That was the reason why I made this choice. And so because of that, I think it's really important for people to know that technology is never culturally neutral. It cannot be. And when we use it, we need to be very aware of that and very careful in how it influences us and how we might want to use it and which technology we might want to choose.
Katrina, thank you so much for coming on the show. Today's conversation reminds us that technology isn't just about circuits and code. It's culture in digital form. And now every interface that we interact with, every algorithm, every perfectly rounded button that carries assumptions about how people think, behave, plan, and even relate to each other. And the big thing is when those assumptions collide with different realities and the shock isn't just a glitch, it's a signal. And if there's one thing to take with you today, it's this. Technology doesn't become universal by pretending we're all the same. It becomes universal by learning how to honor how different we truly are. So until next time on Breaking Math, stay curious, stay critical, and be aware of the systems that shape your life.